This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Conda Mason's Brown Rice Hour, a podcast that quilts together a fabric of connection between land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Discover a connection that engages with the most inspiring and cutting-edge thought leaders today, pointing toward our collective healing and liberation. If you are interested in supporting the Brown Rice Hour, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Conda.
So hello, everybody. I'm back and I am Conda Mason with the Brown Rice Hour. And on the Brown Rice Hour, we have intersectional conversations of land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Those are my favorite topics to talk about: land, race, money, culture, and spirit. And so today's guest is one of my dearest, dearest loves and friends and colleague and bestie. And his name is Dr. David Ragland. So welcome, David, to the Brown Rice Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, of course, of course.
Such a pleasure.
Yeah, I'm sorry it took so long. You know, I've been, I actually had you down, like I make little folders for everybody, and I had you in a folder already for July back last year, and nothing was in it.
I remember we tried to make it happen. Yeah,
that's right. So here we are. So happy to have you, David. And so I always begin. I like to begin with creating a little bit of sacred space, and I like to begin actually with you know, a little land acknowledgement and where you are and where I am. And would you like to let us know where you are? What indigenous land are you sitting on right now?
Sure. I am in Rockland County in New York. I'm on Ramapo Lenape land.
Okay. Very good. I am actually was in Oakland most of this time on Brown Rice Hour, but now I'm in Louisiana. Right in central Louisiana, and I'm in the land of the Chitimaca tribe, the Coushatta, the Choctaw, and the Tunica Biloxi tribe of people who this is their land that I am here on, and honored to be here and to give them full respect. And I like to also do a little centering around and honoring, you know, our ancestors. We do a lot of ancestor work, you and I, and it's so important to me that we look at our ancestors, that we honor them, that we understand that they are us and we are them, and I wouldn't be here without them and the sacrifices and the love that they carried and that they carried through, particularly as formerly enslaved people who have done so much to get me here. Mm-hmm. And so I'm forever grateful for that and for your ancestors as well. And David, that I know in order for us to be here, they went through a lot. And I also think about those who are still to come before us, you know, whose ancestors we will be. And that we will be good ancestors. I'm always praying that I will listen to the whispering in my ear of my ancestors so that I can learn to be a good ancestor for those who are coming. If there's anything you'd like to add to that, you're welcome.
Or I was just thinking about my grandma Goldie.
Grandma Goldie.
Who was an organizer. Not in no sense, but just deeply focused on community and family.
Nice. Is that your mother's side or your father's side?
My mom's mom.
Your mom's mom, Grandma Goldie.
My mother was the oldest of 11.
Oh, nice. Nice. Wow. That was a lot of mothering she had to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing when we think about, you know, what our parents, how even their lives, even before, just as close to us as our parents, how different it was than our own. And so just good shout out to all of our people. And may we, again, just do the good work that we're here to do and become the ancestors that we want to be. Mm-hmm. So I want to begin by describing your work, David. So you described it as you're the co-founder of the Truth Telling Project of Ferguson, and you're the director of the Grassroots Reparations Campaign. Mm-hmm. And I have a short bio here that I want to read to say a little bit about who David is and the depth that this man is. Dr. David Ragland is one of the co-founders and co-executive director of the Truth Telling Project and the director of the Grassroots Reparations Campaign, which we will go into in this conversation together today. Georgetown University's Advocacy Lab included Dr. Ragland's research as part of the most important research on advocacy in the last 40 years. And David was recently inducted into the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Collegium of Scholars at Morehouse College. And he served as the senior Bayard Rustin Fellow at Fellowship of Reconciliation, and as a board member for the Peace and Justice Studies Association. Dr. Ragland's recent publications include Truth-Telling as Colonial Human Rights Education in the Movement for Black Liberation, and another article called Truth-Telling from the Margins, Exploring Black-Led Responses to Police Violence and Systemic Humiliation. So David, that's a lot to unpack that I want to talk about. It sounds so heady. You sound like, you know, it's all in your head. And I know you are so deeply filled with heart. So we're going to do that. We're going to start. Well, actually, I'm going to start with the belly. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start with the belly. So the first question that I'm going to ask you is mm-hmm. this. Mm-hmm. So this is called the Brown Rice Hour. And one of the reasons I call it the Brown Rice Hour is that I love brown rice. And it was pivotal in the transformation of my diet when I went from meat eating into macrobiotic, and it just changed everything. And it's been catalytic for me, and I just love it as well. And I grow it actually right now. So I'm a foodie, and I am interested always, and I think it just kind of reveals a lot when people answer this question. And the question is, what food was it that was prepared for you when you were a child that was like that comfort food that you just, you know, and who prepared it for you?
It was spaghetti and catfish sandwiches.
Wait a minute, what? Say that again. Spaghetti and catfish sandwich. Both of those are a sandwich.
Yeah, catfish sandwich. Well, not on the same thing, but just you know.
Oh, okay.
Catfish on white bread with hot sauce, pickles, tomatoes, and also collard greens.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was I would have to say it's actually like really the spaghetti and collard greens. Those are things that I cook today.
To this day. Who prepared it for you back when you were a kid?
My mama.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Was she a good cook?
She's okay. She's all right. But you know, when you cook, when you're the oldest of 11, and you support that mothering and cooking for all of those kids.
Mm.
You know, at a certain point, she just stopped cooking.
Okay.
And like, y'all do it.
So she was the oldest of 11 kids.
Mm-hmm. And she would always make us a pot of spaghetti and collard greens like that. It wasn't that it was great. It was just, it was home.
Home.
It was care.
Yeah.
And comfort. You know, and I think I make better collard greens and spaghetti now, but, you know,
hey.
Not to hate on my mama.
But, no, we ain't hating on mama. But it's just, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. And that's good. So it still gives you that kind of feeling of comfort and home. And actually
so I'm the youngest and my brother and sister were away at college. It was for a while. It was just me and my mother had quit cooking. And I was just like, mama, how come you don't cook no more? You know, and it was in addition to like doing other stuff. And I was like, ain't this woman's work? And she said, you gonna cook and you gonna clean. And you're going to cook and you're going to cook and clean for me and you're going to wash the clothes. And I was like, in this woman's work? She was like, nope, just in case you get somebody who don't know how or want to.
That's right.
For you. So that domesticated me in the sense that like, it's like that mothering work is men's work as well. And it's necessary for men to nurture, to unravel or be part of unraveling misogyny.
Yeah.
So that was some early lessons through food that I learned.
It's interesting because I wasn't planning on thinking that we would go in this direction, but since it's here, I've told you once before, and I'll say it, you know, in public that the men that I know in my life, you are, I would say, one of, if not the most feminist, womanist man that I have in my life, and how the total integrity of how you walk. And now it's going back to your mother. We never had this conversation. And so it's been building a long time because there's so much pressure to go the opposite direction in society, right? The men thing. And you have all that, I'm sure. I mean, to the degree that you need to navigate, but the way you navigate as a feminist Black man is unparalleled for me and the people that I know.
Thank you for saying that. I know I have a lot of work to do, and I have to credit Maxine Green, who was one of my professors when I was in grad school at Columbia, and Betty Reardon. I wrote my dissertation, not that means anything, but I wrote it on feminist theories of justice. But then I think in practice, it was Corey Bush and Imani Scott, who at the beginning of the Ferguson protest, basically like, jumped on my head for my dating practices.
Mm.
And would always remind me when I was being bossy or needed to shut up. And just allowing myself to be encircled by powerful Black women and powerful women in general, because I love my mother. And she taught me how to love women, and she talked to me, and we had conversations, and I love my dad who taught me a lot, but also Danielle, my partner, taught me a lot too. Like, you know, as a Black woman who is a queer, non-conforming woman, taught me so much about gender and actually walking the talk and entering relationships with curiosity as opposed to extraction. So if you're anti-colonialist or anti-racist, you have to be feminist, because bell hooks, right, describes the way in which Black maleness is the way that it is expressed in this moment is an articulation of those first colonial encounters. And that's what decolonization means as well. And I'm here for the liberation, and I'm here to keep learning. And honor the sacred masculinity that there is. Like, it can be both. You can be a man and a feminist. And I'm learning personally how to walk this and have integrity in my relationship. So I'm still learning, but it's through a lot of mess ups.
Oh, I'm so sure. You know, I mean, but if we don't put ourselves out there to mess up, we hide behind safety and continue to perpetuate the status quo that we know that we're supposedly trying to transform. And so it's really important. I'm curious, when having this stance, when you're dealing with other men or Black men who are not feminists, who don't see the intersectionality there, how do you navigate that?
I'm a truth teller. I'm a radical truth teller. I try to tell the truth about what's happening, and I practice it, in my relationships. And I think one of the biggest lessons for me was, if you Black, you got play sisters and play cousins, and you know all of this stuff. And one of my closest, probably closer to me than my own sister, Kathy, came out in the late 90s when we were in St. Louis. And and that moment of coming out made me go back and reflect about my experience in a fraternity and being homophobic as an undergraduate. And like, I was homophobic, but I wasn't like, you know what I mean? Like out
radically,
there.
Radically homophobic. Like you weren't.
Bit is bad. Right.
Right.
But that proximity I remember my dad was driving and talking about my play sister. He said, you know, homosexuality is the downfall of Western civilization. And I said, that's what they said about integration. And he looked at me and was like, huh, you're right. And to look at the ways that misogynoir and homophobia are anti-Black and reflect colonial logic. They actually reflect the internal logic of racism and coloniality.
Can you unpack that? What is that logic?
That logic is the proximity toward whiteness and maleness is valued most, and anything else is a deviation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to describe, I mean, in Western civilization itself is a sham, right? But yeah, in the same ways, and I think I want to say Michael Harriet in The Root said that Black men are the white men of Black people.
Wow.
And that really touched me too. Like, you know,
never heard that.
The way that I didn't want to be a part. I didn't want to reflect anti-Black values. Like, if Black lives matter, then all Black lives matter. And so it was a matter of me confronting these views in my own perspective and trying to walk and live. And then, you know, I met Danielle, who, when we began dating, I didn't know that they were queer, and they had kind of talked a little bit about it. And then I'm confronting it in my own personal relationship in a whole nother way. Then we're raising our child as we're raising them gender neutral. And the stuff that have come out of people's mouths.
Oh, wow.
You know, I don't want to put out my family, but I have a very close family member who, you know, wouldn't acknowledge it and, you know, just dogged me out, said, well, we'll see how your child turns out 20 years from now. Come to find out, it's their job to teach about queerness, identities, right, as a leader in their company, and used me and Danielle and our child as an example.
For real.
So, you know, this is somebody like,
yeah,
really, 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 really close. And I just,
yeah.
So it is, but I confront it. I don't play with folk. Mm-hmm. Because I'm in this movement and these are things I believe in, and I'm not playing around with this. And
yeah.
I think, but also part of it is the need for political education in our communities.
Yeah.
And, but also, and we did some of that in the Truth Telling Project. We did a series of healing circles for Black men. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the Truth Telling Project. Can you explain how it started, what precipitated it, and what it's trying to or has been accomplishing?
So it was really like after Mike Brown had gotten killed, and I was like
in St. Louis,
and I was standing outside of my parents' house because 2 weeks after Mike Brown had gotten killed, another Black man was killed across the street from my parents' house. And it was a standoff between the police. And I was thinking that now our neighborhood was about to erupt. And somebody called me and said, what are you doing? And I was like, well, you know, I'm out here. You know, I might write a paper. I might go to protest. And it was, and he's like, dude, like, aren't you a peace educator? Like, don't you? And it was that moment. And it was another moment where I was talking with a friend, like on the night Mike Brown got killed, that night.
Mm.
And I was telling him, because I was teaching in Bucknell at the time. And I said, yeah, I had just taught this class about Palestine, or I took my students to this protest, you know, protesting at the Israeli embassy because they wanted to understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or really, really Israeli apartheid. Mm. And he was like, you know, we got our own Gaza here. And that just like, it just, you know. And so we initially started it because we were thinking like, you know, conversations that are going to be needing to have, and then we started thinking about a truth commission around police violence.
Okay.
And it turned into like this quasi truth commission where folk could tell their stories in safe spaces using restorative practices and really like resituating like who tells the truth. And what we ended up doing was creating this online learning platform, right, that held people's stories, and folks from all over the country ended up coming to Ferguson to tell their stories. Sandra Bland's sister, Tamir Rice's mother and brother, and just folks from all over the country. as a way to be in control of our own stories and our own narratives.
Yeah.
And we ended up thinking and moving around a lot around reparations, because I remember one of the last hearings I was in, I was sitting in the back listening to some of the truth tellers tell their stories about, you know, what their family members and they had experienced encountering police. And I saw white folks crying, walking out the room, and I got angry, right? Because it was also, at that time, the 100-year anniversary of the East St. Louis racial massacre, right? Where it happened all over the countries, you know, all over the U.S., where, you know, there are white mobs attacking black folk. And I was just thinking, like, you know, we've been telling our stories and trying to get people to empathize with us for so long. And I was just like, truth telling has to lead to reparations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's when we started thinking about reparations. And like that next year, we began in earnest having conversations with Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth and Fellowship of Reconciliation and other organizations to think about reparations as a spiritual practice.
Now, that's what I'd love to talk about, because, you know, I know that you come to reparations and this work from a spiritual practice place, from a place of spiritual practice. And I know when, typically, I think when Americans, especially white Americans, they think of reparations, it just sounds like, oh, I'm going to lose something, or you want money, or whatever it might be. And you have a holistic view of it. I'm curious if you can explain to people, what is the spiritual aspect of reparations as you see it?
Well, I mean, I think in part.
And also a little bit about your own spiritual practice at some point.
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, so I look at reparations as repair. Like repairing something that is broken, and it is what is deeply broken is like the fact that from the highest kind of at the highest like religious and spiritual levels in the Western tradition, there was this doctrine of discovery, right, that says that, you know, anybody who's not Christian is not human, and so you can take their lands and subjugate them, right? And so like that was this justification for like the creation of Africans as inhuman in the European imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So the breach is spiritual. Right. The thing that allowed people to treat black folk and non-white folk as inhuman, to extract from people and land, inhabit bodies, like all of the things that colonization and slavery did, was justified, like at this core understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so reparations has always been a part of every single spiritual tradition, like making amends. Like you do something wrong,
mm-hmm.
right? You pay it back.
Mm-hmm.
You make repair, right? Because you know, Jennifer Harvey in her book Dear White Christians writes, if white folk want racial reconciliation, right, then they should pay reparations, right? And so, like, we look at reparations as amending of this historic gap that goes to the very core of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, slavery didn't just happen. It continued. It's ongoing. It continued in policing. It continued in in the carceral system. It is continuing there. Like one of the only places that slavery is still allowed, right, in the U.S. Constitution is in incarceration, right? Colorado just had an amendment to disallow that, right? But, you know, at some very core levels, this country has given up morality for economic progress. Mm-hmm. And played a trick with themselves too, right? Because Joseph Ellis in the book Founding Brothers writes about how there was this rigorous moral debate in the Constitutional Congress about slavery. And the Quakers even put in a petition to immediately abolish slavery. And they, of course, decided not to. But on top of that, they set it up so that there would be no records or discourse or public acknowledgement of their conversation until their first generation of founders died. So there was enforced silence about the debate so that the inhumanity or the subhumanness of Black folk would be something that was a given and accepted in this society.
Yeah.
And so we thought that that because religion and faith and spirituality was at the core, right, of slavery, right? Look at in the early 1800s, the slave Bible was introduced in the Deep South, but by the Episcopalian Church by the Anglican Church for the West Indies, right, and the Caribbean. Because, you know, that slave Bible took out every mention of freedom and liberation.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to ask you about the slave Bible. So it varies from the Bible as we know it, and it deleted freedom and liberation. And
it's probably like less than one third of what the size of the Bible that we know of. And my own self, like, it just made sense to me because, you know, we all know the historical reference about the most segregated time in America at one point was on Sunday morning. And, you know, our movements, abolition was a deeply spiritual, you know, practice. And so, you know, reparations has to also be full abolition. We have to eliminate the systems that emerged during slavery, which are continuing today. Mm-hmm. And so it has to start in our hearts. And if it does not take hold in our hearts, it won't happen. It won't be fulfilled because they'll cut a check and call us a nigga tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what kind of world, or what does a repaired world look like?
Yeah.
And it has to look like changed people. I'm not saying you can't cut my check and keep working on the stuff in the interim, but I appreciate the United Nations definition of reparation, which is, you know, education, culture shifting, healing, mental, physical, spiritual, restitution, returning what was stolen, and guarantees of non-repeat. Don't do that shit no more.
Right.
And what does it take to not do it anymore? It takes a change in heart.
Yeah.
It takes transformation of laws, like what we're on the verge of now. Like we're building critical mass toward like abolishing the carceral system. And also that, you know, we approached it from a spiritual perspective, because if you look at the civil rights era legislation like the Fair Housing Act, mm-hmm. you know, the Fair Housing Act has been used to essentially fuel, even under the Obama administration, decades of gentrification. Mm-hmm. Where the Center for Investigative Journalism is reporting how hard it is for Black people to get a mortgage. Right? Under the same laws that was supposed to allow them to us to get mortgages, allow us to be able to live in our own communities and fix our houses.
Right.
And so it has to be a heart level change.
Yeah.
And every white person in America, whether descendant from slaveholders or not, has a stake and owes reparations.
So that's a good question that I want to get to. God, there's so much to unpack. There's so much I want to say in everything you said. It's brilliant. And I'm hearing you say that as a person, particularly as a white American, a white person in America, that the key to getting towards understanding and embodying is that it has to be embodied. Reparation has to be embodied as literally within your body, within your heart. You know, the Donella Meadows saying that the most effective way to make transformation in any system is to change the mindset that created the system, which completely makes sense, right? Changing the mindset that created the system. And so people today don't think, white folks today, I don't believe, think that they created this system. And so I didn't create the system. I wasn't there when this happened. Why am I responsible? What does this have to do with me? Can you answer that?
Sure. You know, they may not, the current white folks may not have created it, but they benefit from a system, right? So for instance, there's a direct correlation between the experience of Black people every day and between white folk. You know, so for instance, if we look at policing, for instance, which is a really good example, right? Because, you know, policing as we know it today is a direct descendant of the slave patrols, right?
Absolutely.
You know, where any white person anywhere, slave owners or not, were, you know, required to essentially, you know, turn in that person, right? And even take their life, right? If it came down to it. And so we look at it on a policy level, you know, police over police Black neighborhoods because they're not focusing on white communities, because mm-hmm. they act in ways as they act like security guards for white neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just like the surface level, right?
Right.
You know, what about like the Northeast, right? You know, people in the Northeast like are thinking, well, you know, we're in the North, you know, but they benefited from the banks, right? That underwrote, insured slavery, right? They also the public bonds that created, you know, municipalities, right? They also invested mm-hmm. in slave, like actual cities invested in slaveholders, you know, slaving,
right.
Ship making, that ships were built in the North, right? Zora Neale Hurston's most recently, posthumously yeah. published book, right, was talks about the ship that was built in New Hampshire, I think it was New Hampshire, that transported the last mm-hmm. batch of slaves.
Right, right.
So there's all these connections. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in addition to, even if you were immigrants, you walked into a system, right, that was built on slave labor and theft of land, right? And so there's all these connections, and often people who say that just want to find a way out, you know. But, you know, this country is adept at hiding and renaming and changing history around so that people can find convenient reasons as to not do and acknowledge what is right.
So what is the, for you, what is the link between truth-telling and reparations? And TRC, let's talk about Truth and Reconciliation, TRC.
Well, you know, Truth and Reconciliation is a tool in transitional justice, which is, at least in the last 50 years, right, emerging after all of these dictators, right, U.S.-funded dictators, right, left power and, like, so that people could have gross violations of human rights redressed. And so the elements of transitional justice are truth-telling, criminal justice and prosecution, right, for those who violated human rights, truth-seeking, right, which is like research and documentation of what happened, and reparations, right? Yeah. It's the United Nations actually defines, and that's the kind of the definition that I'm coming from, like, that there ought and must be economic, moral and spiritual and legal, like, reparatory action to respond to gross violation of human rights. So truth telling is that vehicle to that is a moral and political and social inventory about what happened.
And that does that not begin with education, right? Because a lot of people just don't know. They really don't know what happened. I mean, the schools are not. I just saw somewhere last year that who was it that did the study? It's a Black organization in Montgomery, not EJI.
Not EJI?
No, the other one.
Is it the Proctor Conference?
No. Anyway, they did a study that said that they were looking at that 80% of high school students do not know that the Civil War was connected to slavery and had to do with slavery. I mean, that's the kind of education of the kind of lie telling that is actually happening. So not only do we have to do truth telling, we have to stop the lies, right, and then move into the truth. Social and educate ourselves, because if we don't do it ourselves, it's not, I mean, you know, so there's so much proactive. I think we're talking about people becoming proactive in their own education, reading the articles, reading the books, being proactive to a group of our citizens who don't really read that much anymore, or are not that, curious, should I say, and rather settling with life as it is and as it comes. And that means perpetuating the system that we have. And so it's really, I think, when you talk about truth telling, which I love the word truth telling, and it just goes to the core of me. I think that the truth is something that people don't really even know what the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so this level of self-educating is really important. And how do we do that?
Mm-hmm.
How do we do that for our people, white people, black people?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I think that, like, to tell the truth is a radical act, right?
Yes.
In this moment, because of what you described as, it is socially sanctioned and produced ignorance, right? To say Black people were transported here, right? And domestic workers, right? As opposed to stolen.
Yeah.
Right? And child trafficked and on, right? And like we're seeing it in Georgia, right? But I think that what happened in Chicago, and not recently, not Evanston, like, that's important too, but I'm talking about the Chicago Torture Justice Center,
mm-hmm,
which is a result of activists out in the streets demanding that there be reparations now,
right?
For the torture chamber of one of the police commanders, John Burge, for decades tortured Black folk, for so many confessions.
Yeah.
And part of the outcome of that reparations was education.
Yeah.
Like, they had to include what happened. in Chicago education. And then they created a torture justice center so that folks actually know.
Yeah.
So like reparations, right? It can't just be a check. It's got to be a way to systemically and socially like educate people about the truth, right? And that's why, you know, reparations is like just the check piece is important. And we can't deny people say, just give me my check. Yeah, yeah, you got it right. Because that's what reparations is. It's moral and material repair for harm. But it's got to be more. It's got to be education and real education about what happened and what continues to happen. Because otherwise, it's going to keep happening.
Right, right. That's right. That's right. Guarantee of no repeat. And the guarantee of no repeat means you got to know what happened as not to do it again. Mm-hmm. And all the circumstances, all the factors, all the causes and conditions that surround it, this whole need for reparations.
Yeah. You know, Sojourner Truth said that the it's something like the greatest antidote to injustice is the truth, is to shine a light on the truth.
Yeah.
But it also hurts. When you shine a light on somebody when they sleep and they like, oh, it's too, you know, it's
too bright.
Or even Plato's cave allegory about shining the light on directly on the people and how painful it is because they've been stuck in one position. Mm-hmm. You know, like people are stuck.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm not going to use it to like in not awake to this history and don't want to be.
But at the same time, though, we got to say, David, this is what I'm seeing. And I know you are, too. I have never been more hopeful.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
Than where we are right now with reparations and what is happening, that it is in. It is in the political lexicon. People are talking about it. And where was that? Evanston, Illinois? The first city that just the city council last week, I think it was, that declared reparations, that they were going to do reparations to the black citizens of that city. I just feel like it's never been closer mm-hmm. now than it has ever been. Mm-hmm. And so HR 40, I don't know what's happening. I mean, there's just so much going on and people are waking up. Mm-hmm. People are waking up to that word that used to just be ridiculous. Like, are you kidding me? Reparations. Like, even though when you look over history outside of this country, how many countries have done reparations for atrocities that have happened to groups of people, right?
And Great Britain just got finished paying descendants of slave owners reparations,
That's right. That's right.
But we have examples here.
Oh, there's so many worldly examples in the United States. It's just, but I do feel, David, that right now we are on the cusp of something breaking through. It's little by little. And the work that you're doing is such a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, like, if you were to, speak right now, like write to folks mm-hmm. who are struggling with reparations and the concept, what do I do? How do I support it? What does it take? Where do I go to learn? Mm-hmm. Just what kind of resources would you give folks right now in this moment?
Sure. I would send them to the Grassroots Reparations website, grassrootsreparations.org.
Grassrootsreparations.org. Okay.
I would also, there's so many resources. Like, that's actually like...
I know, there's so many now. What about Reparations for Slavery by Lottie Dula?
Reparations for Slavery. Actually, that's where I would send people first.
Right, Reparations. And that's Reparations with the letter four, the number four, slavery.
.com. Because it walks you through. And for folks who just don't know anything, like I actually send people there.
Yeah, that's where I send folks.
I feel like what we're talking about is just a little bit like, you know what I mean? That not that her stuff is simple. It is like she's a straight shooter. And she just tells people like this, you know, and from a person who, you know, and so the founder of reparationsforslavery.com, Lottie Dula, is someone who is a descendant of enslavers, and has immigrants, right, on one side and then the other side. So like, you know, she's able to like see it in both of these ways and didn't know until recently.
Discovered that her ancestors were enslavers, found the little book with the names of all these enslaved human beings.
Mm-hmm. I really think that that's probably the best place to go.
Reparationsforslavery.com.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We gotta lift up Lottie and the work that she's doing. The website is deep and incredible, very accessible. Mm-hmm. Every door that you open, there's just so much richness there. And
you can spend a year and not be exhausted with
totally,
all the in there.
Totally. And not read all of it. But you get a sense of what to do. Mm-hmm. And then she's doing also other work outside of the website that's connected to the website, actually, with people, and is a part of, I'm very fortunate to say. And so now I've got to be transparent and say that David and I, we work together. Mm-hmm. He is a part of my nonprofit called Jubilee Justice and Jubilee Justice Journeys, where we work with people. And we work as cross race, cross class, people of wealth, people of financial wealth, people of spiritual wealth, people of thought leadership wealth, coming together, and at this intersection of land, race, money, and spirit, and uncovering so much together, working a lot with our ancestors and the ancestral line, and really being able to discover together, letting go of the whole thing that I think that stops people, and this shame, blame kind of energy that is really, to me, just something that just is a way of stopping yourself from moving forward. But David and Lottie are all a part of our good, beautiful team together. And I have the pleasure of every week being in community with this man right here and with Lottie. So we're going to have to close now, David. And I just want to say, you know, your brilliance and your work is just, it's impeccable. I am grateful to have you as my friend and my colleague and my teacher. I'm constantly learning from you. And it's just such a pleasure to be in your universe. And I'm just happy to introduce you to whoever's listening out there and who pays attention to this podcast to understand you and your work and how you lead. And it's just, it's
Lottie, I feel that way about you.
Yeah.
About you. Like I'm honored to work with you and know you. And it's just been like, you changed my life. Like, you know, I like you, cause you know, I've been thinking about spirituality and then I met you and we just like went deep, we threw the top, like it just you just opened my life up. Like I'm telling you. So kind of,
I asked you that last question is, what is your spiritual practice? Can you talk a little bit about it? And we'll close with that.
I grew up Christian, went to Catholic schools my entire life. I in college, I converted to Islam. And I've been a Muslim all of my adult life. And in the last few years, I have been studying and exploring Yoruba faith traditions and traditional African spirituality and trying to decolonize my spirituality. and reclaim what was stolen. So it has been, you know, like my own spirituality was just just tumultuous, trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, when I thought I got something in one place, it was just like, you know, and then I just, you know, working with Louisa Teach, just to shatter my whole life and what I thought was possible and what I thought I could do. And then working in this group, right, with you, Conda, like, in approaching everything from spirituality, like, you know, it really, like, made me go deeper and not just for performance sake.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it also has made me want to slow down and, you know, lots of changes are happening in my life that are going to help me slow down and go deeper and be spirit led. So, but it's also full circle too.
Yeah.
I told you about the prayer meeting.
Yeah. Like the prayer meeting.
And it also just validates the things that were underlying what we already had and knew and grew up with, but didn't know how to put a name to it.
Yeah.
You know, like people are like, that's just being Black. I mean, like it is, if you go into a Black church, it's something there that goes beyond the colonization of Christianity.
Yeah.
For people.
Absolutely. There is.
It at a vibrational level, at you know, there's history in that, there is resilience in that.
Yeah.
You know, it's talking to the ancestors. When you don't know, you're talking to the ancestors.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And the music, which you always bring. You always bring the music, David.
I say.
And the core of our, of, you know, of being human is music and art. And that's what you bring always to every time we gather. So anyway, I guess it's time to close. I want to say thank you, David. Thank you so much. This has been such a wonderful conversation. And I just hope people walk away with understanding the spirituality of reparations and why it's so important and how it all began with, as you pointed out, you know, the denial of the spiritual essence of certain human beings. And so we got to go back that way. You got to go back in the way it came in, or else it will be repeated again. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for doing this. This is super dope.
Yeah, it's awesome. All right, darling. All right. Much love.
Much love.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.